even though what is there may bear no resemblance to our expectancy. Consequently, Buddhism takes the position that if the individual can release his faculties from their addiction to prevailing opinions, can save himself entirely from that opinionism which Heraclitus called the falling sickness of the reason, that it is possible by the most profound internalization in a condition which we might term abstract meditation, for the individual to have a glimpse of at least the shadows of reality, that it is conceivable that the person can have a clear impression from the universe of the universal purpose itself, that it can be true and proper, that within man there are some superior faculties which cannot know all things, but which can extend the boundaries of internal knowledge nearer to cause than any processes that we can use intellectually, rationally, or scientifically. Therefore, that instead of thinking about the universe or thinking up a solution for the universe, there is a condition or situation in which the universe can impose its own condition upon man. The universe can define itself, not in words, not necessarily even in symbols, but simply in impact. That the great mystery of life produced man. Therefore, man is bound to that mystery. He is in rapport with it in some way, whether he knows it or not. And that which produced him can reach him, can in some way bestow itself upon him if he does not interfere with the transmission. Meditation is consequently the achievement of a receptivity by which the individual can intuit that which he cannot intellectually comprehend. Out of this can come a tremendous, unchanging resolution of acceptance of life itself. The individual, as in the case described by Havelock Ellis as to his own experience in the dance of life, the individual can have something that happens to him by means of which all doubt, all uncertainty, all question simply ceases. It is not that the questions are answered, but by some mysterious power, the questions are no longer important. Something transcends all question with certainty. Something transcends all doubt with a tremendous capacity for a dynamic acceptance. In some way, perhaps, this is man's nearest approach to deity. And according to the Tibetans and others, there is a moment in the transition of the human being from this world to wherever he is going, the moment of death. In that moment, there is this mystical experience. In the moment of transition, the individual has this flashing acceptance, has this strange, incredible realization that he is entering into a reality rather than a vacuum, that some way where he is going and how he is going to get there, is these are no longer important. There is a tremendous sense of a complete rightness, a tremendous, overwhelming sense of security which seems to come only when man has reached the final end of his insecurity in this world. This is perhaps why the Buddhists insist that the nirvanic experience at the end of the evolutionary process of man, the achievement of the transcendent consciousness, in which the individual is no longer conditioned, the condition itself being suspended or transfigured by something else, that in the moment of this nirvana, and in this moment only, the Buddha achieving enlightenment becomes fully aware of the measure of enlightenment. Again, perhaps, not knowing the answers to all the questions, but reaching a state in which there is no longer any inclination to ask the questions, because a supreme fitness, a supreme sufficiency, moves in upon the individual and quiets forever all of his doubts regarding providence. Some way, this is supposed to be the end of all human evolution, that man shall come into an accord with truth. Not that man shall possess it, but more correctly, possibly, truth shall possess man. Evolution is the releasing of these faculties, perceptions, and means, by means of which the individual can escape legitimately from the mysterious cycles of embodiment in which he is at this time so completely imprisoned. Paracelsus von Hohenheim, the great Swiss physician and mystic, then began to study the body of man rather attentively. It is astonishing that a people, for the most part, prohibiting dissection, and therefore with very little scientific knowledge of the internal workings of the human body, should have accomplished so much in scientific research as far as anatomy and physiology are concerned as the Grecians. It is astonishing that they gained so much. The clinics of Hippocrates, of course, were clinics of observation. They were based upon a kind of intuitive study of man. And the Asclepiates of Greece developed an intuitive theory of diagnosis and treatment. We know this. We also realize that to them, this was the proper function of the priest-physician. The priests of the healing god used this internal intuition, cultivated by prayer, by disciplines and meditations, perhaps mostly by consecration to the needs of the sick. This intuition became their guide to the treatment of disease. And in spite of how we may feel about it, they did astonishingly well. So did the Chinese. The Yellow Emperor's Book of Medicine is a very learned work. Learned because it is a book on anatomy and physiology developed by rationalization alone and without practically any clinical or dissectional knowledge. It might be termed an empiric system. It was simply achieved by imposing the universe upon man and assuming that man was a miniature of the world and treating him in this way, so that all methods of treatment were based upon astronomy and sidereal motion. That actually sickness and health were cosmic mysteries related to the sun and moon and to the motions of the stars. This did not follow that the Yellow Emperor's Book of Medicine was an astronomical or astrological thesis. This is not the fact. The fact is, however, that it did recognize that the human being was a little universe, and that therefore all the principles that men could study in nature were applicable to man. The Druids of Britain developed the theory that there was a plant in the earth for every star in the sky, and that just as the combinations of stars form diagnostic patterns, so the herbs of the earth, when combined, constituted the perfect remedies for all ailments. One of the old Druids said that there is not a sickness of the flesh, but that there is a flower, or a plant, or a shrub which is its proper remedy, and that you may not have too much difficulty in discovering it. The leaves, the roots, the buds, the fruit, the plants themselves have some mysterious resemblance to the ailment for which they are the cure. It is only a matter of skillful observation to discover the right ones. We no longer think this through, but most of the old Druid and Paracelsian remedies that were developed, and many of those developed in China and India and Egypt, are now in the modern pharmacopoeia. We no longer are told where they came from, because actually they came from people who gained their knowledge through dreams and visions and magic. And these are not considered solid foundations. The only disconcerting factor is that the remedies work. The same is true of your American Indian medicine priest. I have talked with several, and years ago brought one here to Los Angeles to live with me. He told how he was called by the gods of healing, how he went out into the desert at night and prayed. And as he walked along in the night, he asked the old ones and the true ones to give him the remedies for the sicknesses of his people. And as he prayed and walked, he would say, "This old Indian, who is very good, is very sick. He has great pains and misery. He has asked me to bring medicine to him. I am the medicine priest. I must find the remedy." So he would go out and walk in the night. And he told me, he said, as I was walking along, praying and asking, he said, "I saw a little glow form around a weed. This weed suddenly shone like a little star." That was it. So he took the little weed and made a tea of it, brewed it, gave it to the sick man, and the sick man recovered. He said always his remedies came the same way. They came from dreams or visions or little lights around the plants at night when he wandered out to pray and ask the help of the old ones and the true ones who had gone before. This is the way science began. Sometimes we wish it had remained so sensitive to the intuitive mysteries of life. So Paracelsus pointed out that there is within man another universe, a universe of powers, a universe of principles, that within the human being are the remedies for the ailments of his life. Paracelsus said, the Creator has given man three books, by the reading of which he can perfect his knowledge. The first is the universe. The second is Holy Writ. And the third is the human body. From these, duly and properly studied, all can be found that is necessary. But to duly and properly study these, man must be quiet, reverent, humble. He must ask for help. He must ask for the light to shine around the little weed. He must believe that it will shine. So great learning spans millions and men still die. We are not willing yet to pray for light, to ask humbly that the eternal physician be revealed in the works of nature. Also in India, of course, the human body becomes closely associated with the great mysteries of yoga, Vedanta, and Tantra. The human body becomes an alchemical mystery like that of the medieval scientists. Man develops within himself the secret science of his own salvation. He becomes capable of regulating his own body. He gains control over the functions and processes of his own flesh. Little by little, he attains a benevolent mastery of the very body which has been so uncertain and difficult to control. The yoga systems prove conclusively that we can control pain, that we can stimulate and regulate the functions of organs and structures, that we are capable of maintaining this body by an act of will. And among the ancient beliefs, there was one to this effect, that as man achieves his highest evolutionary procedure, he will become capable of the voluntary control, structure, and repair of his own body. That in himself he is the physician, and that in evolution, this power to heal himself will come out of him just as the power to instruct himself arises in his own nature. In the Shingon Shu, the tantric sect of Japanese Buddhists, Dainichi Nyori, seated in the center of a lotus of 8 scarlet petals, represents the eternal Noah in the human heart. Truth, wisdom, God, reality. These are thrown within the heart of man. And man can reach them. Man can call upon himself for all that he needs and all that is necessary. And if he calls properly, he will be answered. Actually, there is no other answer to the problem of justice. If man is forever dependent upon something outside of himself for his survival, for his happiness, for his health, for his well-being, then man must always be dependent upon vast patterns of circumstances over which he has no possible control. If man must depend upon the world for his happiness, he is also forced to accept that the world can be the cause of his misery. In the Indian and Chinese systems, this is simply not possible. No individual is required to be bound to a common pattern of error simply because he has no way of escaping from error. Man is always capable of escaping from any condition of ignorance that afflicts him. The only thing is that he cannot find the answer in books. The individual seeking to escape from the restriction and limitation of the universe can escape from creation only by retiring into himself. Actually, if he goes deeply enough into himself, he finds the door which alone leads out of this maze into the security which we seek. All liberation must come from a motion inward, a motion toward cause, a motion toward root. And yoga and Vedanta teach that the answer is for the individual to find once again his own root and to experience his relationship to universal life. Thus, evolution carries these possibilities, and man likewise possesses these potentials within his own nature. Sometime he must evolve structures, instruments capable of sustaining this new degree of insight which will come to him. The Hindus believe that there will be two more kinds of human beings. These two more kinds will represent, in a sense, two more races. Races beyond any that we know. The first two races of the earth, the race of the sun and moon, have vanished away. The others that we see around us belong to a pattern dear enough to our own kind, so that we recognize fraternity. What lies into the future? What kind of race can come out of this one that will be different from it without taking on something of the improbability of science fiction? The ancients were of the assumption that the next race would be obvious because the flesh of it, the substance of it, would be growing more and more attenuated. The body would be less dense and more sensitive. The nervous system would be infinitely more acute. Also, there would be a new pattern set up between the cerebrospinal and the autonomic nervous system. In some way, not too obvious, man would have two spinal cords, representing an equilibrium of the complete nervous system. It was also very possible that in the course of this procedure, his respiratory system would be markedly changed, that gradually the distribution of energy through the air would give way to a distribution of energy through magnetic poles. That perhaps, in a way, man is anticipating these changes by the conditions that are arising in his society. Air and water pollution have increased. There seems to be no answer. This condition will go on and will enlarge and increase with populations, with the continual growth of man's activities and his knowledge. Consequently, man must accustom or adjust himself to these changes, just as bacterial organisms can learn to survive the most powerful medications that we can turn against them. So man becomes less and less dependent upon the physical situations around him. Perhaps this also is the answer to the problem of population explosion. If the individual is no longer dependent for his nutrition or for a livelihood upon a balance of population, then the number of persons who exist within reason may not be nearly so important. As the individual develops, there must also be a corresponding enlargement of his psychomental receptivity. All evolution were leading to refinements, leading to attenuations and sensitivities, must be motions toward a greater insight into reality. This might have another very important effect upon, for instance, overpopulation in terms of employment. The future condition of man has to be built upon a greater insight than he has now. The systems that he now knows are failing. They represent a condition of living which has ceased to dominate in human affairs. Therefore, new relationships must arise among peoples, new codes of life, new concepts of success. And if, for example, for some reason, man should outgrow his peculiar fatal attachment to wealth, if he no longer would consider possession as status, it would not be long, perhaps, before his entire human society could be greatly altered. And if man outgrows this attitude of possession because his own consciousness is no longer adjusted to it, these changes will be painless. They will simply be the individual passing from an adolescent psychology to a more mature one, by the inevitable natural processes of growth. Also, it is assumed that as this refinement continues, there will be a larger and more active extrasensory band, that the individual will gradually standardize what might be termed extrasensory perception. That what we like to think of now as thought transference or clairvoyance may be a standard faculty, not much more remarkable to the man of that day than sight is to us today. If such is the case, you can immediately realize the tremendous effect this will have upon the social and environmental life of man. If man really possesses a well-developed extrasensory perception, he will no longer be able to keep a secret. Nothing can happen without his knowing the facts of the matter. All promotion, all publicity, all propaganda will lose influence. The individual cannot and will not be deceived. He cannot be exploited. He cannot in any way be prevented from knowing the truth about how other people feel about him. Nor can he prevent other people from knowing how he feels about them. It might be a very astonishing thing if such frankness was thrust upon us. And yet, we can see how the extension of a single sensory perception could completely overwhelm the whole pattern of modern society, forcing it into an entirely different direction. If these all add together to produce what might be termed the sixth root race man, then we perceive an individual who, in terms of our present capacities, is extraordinarily learned. Perhaps the best way that we can parallel this is in the Buddhist concept of the Arhat, or in the Hindu concept of the Mahatma. This exceptional type of person, the illumined sage, the miracle worker, the wonder worker who achieves the incredible simply by obeying natural law, by permitting things to fulfill their own patterns without human interference. If such a race comes into existence, this in itself must be the solution to the problem of our dilemma. In other words, our answer lies in that man will outgrow himself, that his growth will go on. And this growth will probably be most rapid for those who already have begun the cultivation of these characteristics which belong to this type of growth. However we want to look at it, those grow most rapidly who deserve to grow, who create within themselves the causes of their own improvement. We must naturally assume, therefore, that the same type of thing which has always happened is most likely to happen again. As surely as in the ancient legends, human beings entered into and quickened the bodies of beasts to produce men, so another wave or level of consciousness in nature must take upon itself the vestments of the most advanced human types to produce the next general demarcation. Having established this demarcation, the Buddhists say these progenitors, these pioneers, gradually retire, permitting then the normal evolving groups for which they have prepared archetypal vehicles to take over and manage the new kingdom. In this sense, then, the sixth race would represent beings, perhaps almost the perfect scientists. Scientists because error would be almost impossible to them. Science because they would have the common power to know, not to think, to hope, to speculate, to calculate. It would no longer be necessary for them to make an imaginary diagram of an atom because they could not see the real thing. It would not be necessary to go through the laborious process of Einsteinian calculations to discover the bases of the structure of matter and energy. These things would be known by the direct act of consciousness. And is it more remarkable that this could happen than that by an indirect act of consciousness, a scientist, mathematician, could create a formula which, when transformed into process, proves itself to be true on a very abstract level? What the modern electronic engineer is working with today is very close to a new dimension of human insight. But this new dimension has to have one other thing which is as yet deficient, and that is humanity. The gentle dedication of consciousness to the service of good. For without this transformation of vibratory core of man, the next step will not happen. Man can never be given a great step forward until and unless he is capable of using it wisely. So we must have to wait until man grows not only smarter, but better. For betterness is the key to insight. It is by improvement that man conquers himself. By skill he conquers other things, but remaining unconquered himself arrives at his own destruction. The next point then would be to consider the seventh, that which lies beyond the sixth great racial demarcation. In this we have, as always in the Hindu septenaries upon which our present thinking is based, we always have the seventh as a kind of suspension. In the scriptures it is said that on the seventh day the Lord rested. If we slur the word Lord and make it law, on the seventh day the law rests. The law is suspended. The seventh day is consummation, culmination. The seventh step of Buddhism is nirvana, which is the complete suspension of everything. The seventh day of creation is absolute rest. This absolute rest, therefore, means in man the end of that which is not rest, namely restlessness. The seventh represents the final, complete coordination of all the elements and instruments of the human fabric. It is the actual culmination of unification. It is yoga. Absolute union. It means that in this state there can be no longer any dissimilarity, inharmony, or conflict in the structure of man. There can be nothing working contrary to the rest. There can be no polarized opinion. There can no longer be any Aristotelian dichotomies. The individual, his consciousness and everything, transcends polarization or duality of any kind. It is then that being and not being cease, and reality alone remains. The nearest we can gain to the seventh state is that of the conception that the Tendai Buddhists have of the nature of the Buddha Virakana. Virakana is, in a sense, the seventh race consciousness. It is actually the complete suspension of every faculty, force, or power that in any way reflects limitation. It is the utterly unlimited. And the only thing that can be unlimited is that which no longer limits itself and therefore moves into total identity with reality. I think perhaps the old Hindus came as near to the concept as anything that we can imagine. Namely, the gradual retirement of man from objectivity. He will still have a body, but his body will be strangely attenuated, like that of the genie of the Chinese Taoist tradition. The body will be incidental to the person. He may use it if he wishes. If he does not wish it, or does not need it, he does not have to use it. He gradually retires into a kind of luminous meditation in which the world around him is transformed also into the luminous manifestation of the divine power that creates it. When a being, luminous in all its parts, abides in a place which this being experiences inwardly as also all luminous, all light, all mystery, all glory, then we have probably the ground upon which the concept of paradise was devised, or the Edenic garden. So the sage, the tenon, the mysterious magician, master of the Taoist fables, is in a sense this final man that has lost all of its elementary powers or functions because it no longer needs them, and retires more and more into the mysterious, luminous atmosphere from which it came. Perhaps ultimately, at the end of the race, the end of humanity, man dying out like sparks in space. Not because man dies, but from this perspective, man dies. The sparks return to the flame. And that which we have experienced or known as humanity ceases. And the lower kingdoms growing up upon the earth take over the empty throne, creating new types of life, new orders of existence. But just as surely as the ancients believed that man came here out of an abode of light, came here, however, like a prodigal son, descending into embodiment for experience, descending as a sleeping soul into birth, so truly in the end, fully awake, fully understanding the mystery of the life cycle through which it has passed, and the reason for that cycle, the transcendent being returns again to the luminous sphere from which it came. Evolution goes on here. Perhaps someone with only a physical perspective would hardly notice the difference. The old forms go on, but new lives are moving through them. It is exactly as though we stood and watched a city day after day. In 100 years, the streets would still be filled, but not one of the people would be the same. So in the world, the stream goes on. But who knows what strange chemistry takes place behind the masks of matter, the masks by which men think they recognize each other. But these masks are only a persona. And behind the mask is a face that may change. But we never notice the change because the mask does not reveal it. So all through nature, orders of life are changing. But we do not know this because they move through the forms which have been fashioned for their housing. The ancients likewise tried to consider how far man could go. What, after all, is man as we know him? He is a body, he is a consciousness, he is a being, he is something with a spark of life in his heart. Where is he going? How can we really guess where he is going? We know he came from less, and we know that he goes to more. But how much less did he come from, and how much more does he go to? In Hinduism and Buddhism, all life ultimately reunites itself with some form of an overlife. In Hinduism, it is Atman. Atman is the eternal soul or eternal self. Buddhism, not recognizing Atman, posits instead the complete suspension of all conditions as in nirvana. But it clearly points out that nirvana is not total extinction. It is only the extinction of that which experiences separateness. So that beyond separateness is another kind of life that we do not fully appreciate right now. But the Atman, or the final over-self, whether it be union in consciousness with the Buddha, whether it means the ultimate attainment of Buddhahood itself, which the Buddhist tradition affirms, or the Hindu Atman, or reunion with God, or oneness with the infinite. The concept is that what we call evolution has an over-pattern, a pattern larger than anything that we can appreciate. That these separate sparks which make all forms of life, from the tiny gnat floating in the sunbeam, from the electron and the atom, from all the kingdoms of nature, and even into the mysterious divine hierarchs described in the visions of saints, all of these sparks of life were cast from a single fire. One tremendous consciousness called Atman. This consciousness, in the form of Vishnu, floating upon the coils of the seven-coiled serpent of eternity on the ocean of space, represents, strangely, the total nature of life. At some time in the Hindu mythology, this total life, this Brahma, this eternal Vishnu, this Lord Shiva, entered into the illusion of creation, becoming the great mendicant, adorning itself with ashes, wearing clay and sackcloth, the symbol of embodiment. And this one spiritual flame broke up into an infinite diversity of sparks. And each of these sparks became a living thing of some nature. And these sparks are infinite, as life is infinite. And these sparks are seed-like and germinal. And in this form, the great deity died. It was buried within creation itself, went to sleep in its own dream. In some of the Eastern fables, it is said that this being entered into meditation, and in its meditation imagined itself to be embodied, and went through the processes of embodiment as an inner function of its own consciousness. And this inner function we know as creation. In any event, this supreme power became infinitely diversified through infinite time and infinite space. And then, in the processes of evolution, these forms which were built around the primordial sparks grew more and more adequate. The purpose of the growth of form was not that form should improve. The form grew only that the life within the form might have a nobler mansion. The whole problem of the unfoldment of form is merely that it is only in this way that life itself can become released from form. Evolution is an escaping of life from the inadequacy of form by creating better forms until finally freedom is achieved in the perfect form. When this freedom is achieved, the sparks do not simply go out into space and become dissipated. They do not fade away because they were never mortal. These sparks reunite, gradually assembling themselves into this mysterious abstract form which was their original. They move like a cloud of fireflies, back again to reassemble into the nature, consciousness of being and being of Atman. And when the last of these little sparks has been freed from matter, Atman awakes from its sleep. At that moment, Atman is free. The God which created the world by entering into it and sustaining it with his own existence has been liberated. The evolution of man is the resurrection of God. Now, this is a daring thought, particularly coming from thousands of years ago. But it has influenced the philosophies and theologies of all peoples. It seems to give at least one somewhat adequate concept of what things might be like and why they are as they are. Actually, man is forever trying to justify the universe to which he belongs. Some say this is superstition, that the only thing the individual wants to do is to have something to lean on. That unless he evolves a theology or a psychology or a philosophy that has vast dimensions and proportions, he is afraid. He is afraid of being alone in the darkness of his own ignorance. This is, I think, a rather sophisticated point of view. A lot of it has gained momentum in the disillusionments following two world wars. But the fact still actually remains. The disillusionment solves nothing. It brings no real answer. Disillusionment does not tell us why we're here. Usually, disillusionment ends by taking away from us even the concept of the machinery that is necessary in order for us to be here at all. We cannot afford to take too much away, because if we do, there is no one left to be disillusioned. We know, therefore, that there is a process operating, that the misfortunes, infirmities, and inconsistencies of life are actually the greatest proofs of natural law that there are. Rather than discounting natural law, they demonstrate it. And that there has to be some reason. We can have any reason you want, but it would be hard to imagine a more transcendent reason, a more splendid vision, than to realize that existence is an embodiment of universal life. That existence is alive because an infinite life inhabits it. That just as man's mind and consciousness have molded his body into its present proportions and dimensions, so infinite life has molded in space the infinite structure of the cosmos as being the least form capable of manifesting the cosmic purpose. This cosmic purpose, however, is not merely to remain glistening forever in the firmament. This cosmic purpose is not that suns shall go on circling forever around still greater cosmic centers. There has to be more than this infinite continuance of machinery. The time cycles are so vast that man cannot understand them, any more than a tiny gnat in a sunbeam can ever understand the time cycles of man. Yet these cycles exist, and existence is always an infinite pattern of life becoming embodied, passing through the processes of embodiment, and finally passing out of embodiment, and carrying with it in this great procession a parade, a processional of stars, of lives, of infinite sparks belonging to itself. And each of these sparks, an individualization of itself. Now, when these sparks return to form itself again, and the Atman awakens from his mystic trance, what then? Is this the end of things? Is this the termination? The Hindus and the ancients did not believe in terminations. They believed in an infinite life, an infinite growth. They did not hold that it was possible for man to conceive of termination. All he could conceive of was things returning to their own natures and apparently ceasing in these natures. But then the composite nature into which they were returned, blossoming out again after the 7 nights of the pralaya, or infinite sleep. So life goes on, evolving, unfolding. But every experience that occurs in life has meaning. By our experience, we add to the waking of the sleeping Brahman. By the Brahman's experience in coming back to waking from its own sleeping, it adds wisdom to something beyond itself. Life goes on. Life is the infinite manifestation of growth. And men thought this way long before they were disillusioned. Perhaps they were right. Perhaps disillusionment is something that has simply numbed their senses to a splendid vision that we all need. At least I think by the greatness of our vision, we gain a certain inspiration for the immediate regulation of conduct.